Welcome to the Philip K. Dick Book Club. In each episode of this podcast, I look at one of the works by Philip K. Dick in roughly the order that they were published in. So currently we're looking at the stories of 1955, and these stories are, although they deal with a lot of issues, several of these stories are really on the issue of consumerism. And recently we've been kind of looking at a few stories like that, like Foster Your Dead and Nanny, and Captive Market fits into that because it's also a story about consumerism and the lack of choice individuals have in within market economies and within consumer economies, that this idea of kind of consumer choice is overrated. And it's right there in the title of the story, Captive Market. I like this story because we often get these stories from the point of view of like the victims of consumerism. In this case, our main character is actually the beneficiary of the lack of consumer choice. Basically, the capitalist is in a sense our protagonist in the story. But okay, let's just jump into this. Captive Market was originally published in IF magazine in April 1955. IF, Worlds of Science Fiction. This was a magazine that Dick published in a lot, so he was getting a lot of business from IF. You can now find it in the fourth volume of the collected stories of Philip K. Dick. If you got the Citadel cheap editions of these, it's in the Minority Report and Other Classic Stories by Philip K. Dick volume of it. And this is the first story we're looking at that's in the fourth volume. As you probably know, the collected stories of Philip Dick are five volumes long, so we're actually getting through many of his stories. Now, there's some in the earlier volumes we still have to catch up with because based on when they got published, some of them didn't appear in print until a little bit later. But it shows you how far along we are in his short story career. Anyways, the plot, what goes on in this story? Well, our capitalist protagonist or antagonist, depending on your point of view, in the story is named Edna Berthelsen. She's preparing to make her weekly secret business trip. No one else can come along with her on her trips. Now, they're interested. They're like, why do you go on these trips every week? But they're like, they're her secret, important business trip she goes on once a week. Everyone's very curious about it. But since she began her weekly journeys, business has never been so good. So she's like a business owner, like a shop. She runs like a shop. And she's been making a lot of money on these weekly trips. Her grandson, Jackie, asks to accompany her, but she refuses. But he sneaks onto the truck to pursue his youthful curiosity. He wants to see what's going on here. So he's a set of eyes on this trip. All right, so we flash to another setting. And here we're on a devastated and near uninhabitable Earth. There's the crew of a downed spaceship living in a makeshift camp. It's nothing like the setting we just saw. The setting we saw was like regular 1950s America. But this is an uninhabitable Earth, like in a different dimension or a different time. And this downed spaceship, they're trying to survive, and they live on this little camp. Tellman, one of the officers, considers how the crash landing transformed the hierarchy of the unit. Suddenly, people on the bottom were indispensable. For instance, Flannery, who takes leadership over loading the ship with weekly supplies. Professor Crowley is the head of the camp, and he was a former history professor. He notices that the rising levels of radiation, actually they're toxic crystallines positing in the atmosphere, and that will make it impossible for them to stay here much longer. Now, this idea of a crisis situation inverting the class hierarchy on a ship is something, if you read The Tempest, you're probably aware of this. There's that opening scene in Shakespeare's play The Tempest where they're in this storm, and suddenly, like, the crew of the ship, the sailing ship, is all in command, and the feudal aristocratic officers and leaders don't really have much say in what's going on. And that's kind of what happens here too. Where with the crash of the ship, basically the people in command can't lord it over the lower class people in the hierarchy anymore. But the situation we learned from John Crowley, this former history professor who maybe has a bit of scientific knowledge, is that this is going to be, you can't really stay here much longer. But spirits are high because they think that this is going to be their final delivery. This delivery will be the last one, which will allow them to finally, you know, repair their ship and get out of here. And they're waiting for this delivery. They discuss how they're going to pay for goods, and they pay the goods with worthless money they find laying around Earth. So basically, this devastated Earth has all this money that no one needs anymore. It's useless post-apocalyptic setting. But they're also kind of fascinated how seriously the delivery woman takes their business, because they don't take seriously the money they're giving her, but she really treasures it and covets this money. They do not know why she's able to travel through time, though, to make these business trips. But that's what we learned. So Mrs. Bertheson is this time traveler from the past who, you know, loves this money because that money's still good in her time period. And she's bringing these goods that they need in order to prepare the ship and prepare the voyage to leave and get to a somewhere where they can survive. Once this material from Mrs. Bertheson arrives from the past, the ship will be filled with enough supplies to allow them to get home. So back on the truck, Jackie's still riding on the back of the truck as it travels through the town, and then it goes to the more lonely outskirts. Suddenly the ship fades away, and Jackie was left on the road by himself. So he's picked up by two state workers, but he can't really explain to them what happened. So he's not really able to get through this time portal. Bertherson arrives in the camp and discusses the delivery with the commander Crowley. She explains why the prices need to go up. She says it's very difficult to get certain items, and the price is going to go up. Flannery, also of the camp, tells Bertherson that they won't need another delivery. And this is the last delivery. They pay for it. They pay whatever she asks, and they send her on her way back. She tells them, though, that she's already ordered much of the next supply, and she needs their business. But disappointed, she leaves, and the other members of the crew celebrate that this is going to be their last night on Earth. So Bertherson is devastated at this news. This is her big cash cow, and she's going to lose it. On her way back, she decides that with this market drain, she'll need to follow a path. She needs to find a way to continue, essentially, her secret business trips. She cannot let this captive market get away. Now, we learn something about her at this point. We learn that she's a precog, and that the reason she can travel to the future here is she can choose which future to explore. In one of the aheads, that's what she calls them, the aheads, the futures, she sees the ship that will attempt to take off but crash again before escaping Earth. And apparently in other futures, the ship does get away and she loses her market. So she chooses to go to the future in which the ship will not be able to take off. Right? So there's multiple futures, but only one of them keeps this captive market. Others will see the ship fail to take off, but will be less lucrative because it will not involve selling parts to repair the ship. So she takes the correct ahead. So the next time she goes, she's going to take the correct ahead that's going to allow her to make the most money from this captive marketplace. Now, apparently, you know, some timelines that are possible allow them to get away. But it seems that Bertheson doesn't let him take that path. So it seems her precognitive abilities allows her to lock in this market and lock in this ship. So they're stuck there perpetually, because they're never able to escape. They're always going to fail, and they're always going to be tied to Bertheson and her supplies. But that's a choice of Bertheson. Bertheson is manipulating her market to ensure that it's perpetual. And that's what we have going on in this story. So meanwhile, Crowley, they try to take off. Crowley survives the crash with a broken leg, and he realizes they're going to be stuck on Earth and dependent on Bertheson's deliveries forever. So we have the precog here as a very malevolent, powerful entity that can essentially bind people in the future to certain paths. Of course, it's combined with the fact that she's in this some kind of time loop that allows her to do this. So we have basically a set of stories all published around this period of time, which show essentially thematically the same thing, a population bound to a marketplace. In Nanny, it was the Nanny robot people were bound to. In Foster Your Dead, it was civil defense that bound people. And there's another story called Service Call, which does the same thing. And we'll look at that. I think that'll be next week or in a couple weeks. Here we have an extraordinary situation in which someone who can only imagine creating a business opportunity out of. That's what I want to say. It's such an amazing thing. This potential to time travel, this potential to see the future. You have this great ability, this great power. And all she can do about this is figure out a way to make money, right? Which is the most banal thing you could do with such an ability, right? And, you know, you think about like the X-Men, right? And all these people have these mutant abilities, right? And they become superheroes and they do great things and all that. But, you know, in our capitalist world, we can imagine that it'd be much more likely that people with these abilities would just try to make a profit from it, right? And this is why we really shouldn't believe in psychic powers, because if people could read the future, they wouldn't be like wasting their time making a few bucks at like a carnival, right? They'd be making the big bucks somewhere probably, right? They'd be working for corporations and like in Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, where you have precogs who are basically working for corporations to design the next big thing. So we end up with this kind of taking this extraordinary abilities and making this very banal and boring and kind of vulgar. In an aside, there are actually so many wonderful technologies being developed now, but, you know, the market, you know, just takes the most commercially beneficial application of these technologies. And if that's the case, we're all going to end up like Edna Berthelsing, right? Where our potential as human beings is directed just into profit rather than to something, you know, greater. Something rather bizarre about this tale is that Berthelsing insists on doing business with the crew of the crashed ship. Apparently, they are paying for her deliveries with money that's just floating around in this devastated surface of Earth. Couldn't she simply just go to this time, to this future, and collect the money, bring it back? No, but she wants to kind of have this perverted sense of being an honest businesswoman, even though she's binding these people to a future of hopelessness. She insists on maintaining her monopoly and keeping the captive market captive when she doesn't really need to. All right, couldn't she just walk to a bank, you know, that was destroyed in the war, take all the money she wants? Her odious strategy for doing this, not only, you know, well, basically the cost of this is that crew, which can't escape. She could choose to help them escape and still go to this time period and make all the money she wants. But she, in this hope to be an honest businesswoman, she binds these people. She enslaves them. These are her slaves, essentially. She traps them, but she keeps the image up as a proper, hardworking, honest capitalist. And is this not exactly how our economy functions today? They don't use time travel, but the ruling class have a firm grip on the many future trends because they control the innovation, they control investment, they control the political systems, right? Apple knows what the next iPhone is going to be before we do, right? So this is all decided for us by the managers and the marketers and the developers. Many of us are, in fact, in captive markets through debt. Student loans are issued to people who have little choice but to take them out. How else are we going to get these jobs that are rapidly disappearing? Other things like mortgages, consumer electronic plans, cell phone plans, cable bills, internet. And we'll see how the end of net neutrality will affect that captive marketplace of the internet. We have thousands of other devices ensured that the paychecks go back to the bosses in one way or another. And again, I'm not anti-consumerist in the way Dick is. But there is this problem with consumerism in that consumer choice is not really in the hand of the consumer. It's in the hand of the market and the people who create the market. I don't really believe there's an invisible hand. I'm kind of with this historian, I forget his name, Chandler, who wrote a book called The Visible Hand, which is about managers and marketers and the people who create markets. That, you know, the market's not an invisible hand. It's very consciously created by people in boardrooms and in, you know, product development centers and all that stuff. Now, perhaps Berthelsen's insistence on this quote-unquote fair dealing, this is a term she uses, with the camp, reflects these strategies. They insert a market, but they claim to be doing it fair dealing. Like, you don't have to have internet, right? You don't have to buy our cable package, even if I'm the only cable provider in town. You can go without. Is that even possible, though? And as we learned in other stories, like, Foster Your Dead or Nanny, it's not that easy to do without the next best thing in consumer electronics, at least not in Dick's view. And just taking the money that's laying around would be too obvious and too vulgar for this upright businesswoman. Now, there's a subplot here about Jackie's efforts to observe the trip. I don't really know why it's even in here. Maybe it's just filler. Maybe he needed to reach a word limit because it's a rather short story. It's only like 10 pages. Maybe a little bit more. 15 pages. Maybe he needed to add it, but it's kind of useless because she doesn't even get there. But maybe the purpose is to show that only Edna Berthelsen, with her precognitive abilities, can use the time warp, right? And that, but the truck can. Now, that doesn't have precognitive abilities, so I don't know. But it does show the single-mindedness of Berthelsen's scheme, and she's indifferent to her own family and their interests and their goals, just as she is indifferent to the crew of the ship. Now, the backdrop of the story is almost an afterthought, but it's kind of interesting to ponder. We have yet another destructive war that devastates Earth. It forces humanity to flee the planet's surface. So this we've seen before in other stories, like Planet of Transients, for instance. Impossible Planet. We also need to remind ourselves that Dick often uses war to expose the destructive nature of state power, which also, like Berthelsen, is indifferent to the suffering of people. Now, that's a bit of a stretch, I admit, but there might be a parallel there between how Berthelsen treats these soldiers and how the government that destroyed Earth treated these soldiers and other people who suffered due to the war. So that does it for Captive Market. It's a really step up in, I think, his precog stories. Or maybe not a step up, because I still think Simon, Heal My Daughter, and World of Talent are the greatest achievements of his analysis of the post-human. But here, by presenting the post-human as someone who directs their energies only into banal consumer, into capitalism, essentially, to make money, is kind of foreshadowing how he eventually sees them. In a lot of the early stories that we've already looked at, the post-human is a threat. It's a danger. It's because it's so beyond humanity. Edna Berthelsen, although a precog, is the most crude, run-of-the-mill, everyday capitalist. There's nothing special about her emotionally or morally or intellectually. She doesn't want to dominate the world. She's just perfectly willing to enslave a population of a small group of soldiers, you know, for as long as she needs to make money. But it's we see that every day. I mean, there's nothing new or special about this post-human. This post-human is just another capitalist. And this kind of foreshadows what we're going to see with, I think, Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, where the precogs are not solving crimes. They're not even doing anything good. They're just there to, you know, figure out what the next best thing is for business. And that, I think, is a really transformation in how Dick saw the post-human. And maybe it starts with this story. So that does it for Captive Market. A fun story that I think although it's pessimistic, I do think it represents a transformative moment in how Dick sees the post-human. So thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments about this story or about Dick's views of the post-human or the capitalist marketplace, please leave them below. If you had experience with the stories that I missed that I don't quite see, you can comment on those as well. Please leave me an email at 100pagescast@gmail.com, and I'll try to get back to you from there. But that'll be it for now. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back shortly with another story from the year 1955.
Come and possess my tired thoughts once more. That living dies, that living dies.